Good morning. My name is Elaine Holden, and I am pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum to hear today's speaker, Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer. Before we get started, please join me in thanking today's musician, Jose Lizcano, our local sponsor, the Gilbert Verney Foundation, and the provider of our beautiful Boston Fern, Coles Garden Center and Florist in Jaffrey. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Today's talk is being recorded and will be available as a podcast on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, within a few days. Selected Lyceum programs will also be broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio on Saturday nights at 10 p.m. After the presentation, in keeping with Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. Our speaker today is Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer. Dr. Kimmerer is a mother, a scientist, and an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. Professionally, Dr. Kimmerer is a SUNY Distinguished Teaching Professor of Environmental Biology and very well schooled in plant science, having received her master's degree in botany and her PhD in plant ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That brief biography sounds very scientific, very sterile, and I would suggest that the writings of most traditional botanists would be just as sterile, because Western European science is conducted in an academic culture in which nature is viewed strictly objectively, at least in the scientist's definition of objective. But Dr. Kimmerer has seen through the artificial objectivity that modern science often offers us, and after years of working in that scientific environment, she chose to take another path. And both her prose and her poetry reflect what a captivating path it truly is. Dr. Kimmerer has authored both popular and scholarly work that have provided all of us, both scientists and non-scientists alike, with an entirely new perspective of not just botany, certainly not isolated and sterile botany, but instead an enchanting exploration that takes into account all life on our beautiful blue planet. I am sure we all joyfully read her first book, Gathering Moss, A Natural and Cultural History of Mosses, which was awarded the John Burroughs Medal for Distinguished Nature Writing in 2005. Since then, Dr. Kimmerer has written the critically acclaimed book, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants. These writings acknowledge the pure science of plants and then places the real wisdom of nature at the same level, thus allowing her readers to tread the same breathtaking, unifying path that she walks today. As I read Dr. Kimmerer's writings, I was taken at how closely her youthful questions about the whatness of plants so closely resembled the philosophical medieval Latin word quiddity, which is, roughly translated, the inherent nature or essence of something. Synonyms include soul, spirit, nature, life, lifeblood, core, heart, center. At first, she was thwarted in her efforts to learn the quiddity of plants, but in the end, through perseverance and determination, she has indeed found the true spirit of the natural world. This is now called TEK. Traditional ecological knowledge, which is a deeply empirical scientific approach and is based on long-term observation, a way of knowing. More importantly, while on that path of discovery to her way of knowing, Dr. Kimmerer also recovered her connections to her traditional, extended Native American family and became acquainted with all the other families of the world, plant, insect, bird, animal, and even ocean and mountain families, our very real interconnected web of life. Please join me now in extending a warm Monadnock Summer Lyceum welcome to our most distinguished and honored speaker, Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Bonjour. Shabbat das gegish kokwene deshnakas. Bodwe wad me kwenda. Megazedo dem min wamakodo dem. Nin mami kwendem mam bi ya yan. Mikwech kinugego gamijang. I don't speak much of our Potawatomi language. It has become an endangered species. So our teachers ask that we speak it and share it with the world whenever we get an opportunity. In my traditional protocol greeting, I told you that I am a Potawatomi woman of the Bear Clan and also of the Eagles. My name in our language is Shabadaske Gish Kokwe, which means the light shining through sky. I want to thank you all so much for this wonderful invitation to speak in this historic forum and to share a beautiful summer morning with you. And is also our traditional protocol, we always begin with gratitude. And I would ask us that we think back to this morning when we first put our feet on Mother Earth, and that everything we needed was provided for us, that there was sweet air to breathe, a cool drink of water, food to eat, the preciousness of the companionship of otherly living beings, the clouds, the white pines, the blue jays. Gratitude for each other as people, for the privilege of our shared work, and for the original Abenaki peoples in whose homelands we meet today, and for all of the beings with whom we share the earth. And you know, much of everyday society speaks of these miracles around us as natural resources, my science colleagues do, as if they were commodities. And in the ecological sciences, we call them ecosystem services, as if they were somehow the inevitable outcomes of the ecological machine. But words matter, a theme for this morning. And what science calls natural resources, traditional peoples call gifts. Gifts from the beings themselves. And I was once giving a talk at a university where the Department of Natural Resources was reorganizing and they were trying to think of a new name for themselves. So I suggested that they might want to work for the Department of Earthly Gifts. They had just that same response. Who do you want to work for, natural resources or earthly gifts? And though we live in this world which is made of gifts, we all find ourselves harnessed to institutions and certainly to an economy that relentlessly asks us, what more can we take from the earth? And this worldview of unbridled exploitation is, to my mind, the greatest threat to the lives that surround our own. Isn't the question we need, what does the earth ask of us? And it is this question that I hope to explore together this morning. What a powerful question. What does the earth ask of us? And the very premise of the earth asking something of me just makes my heart swell. Could it be that some entity as vast and as generous as the earth has some need of me? Could it be that we are more than passive recipients of her gifts? That we have a role to play in well-being. So deep is this notion of ourselves as humans, as takers from the natural world, that we know that as a populace, we are more often referred to not as citizens, but as consumers. There is another way. What does the earth ask of us? The answer to that question is, I think, of immeasurable importance as we stand at the cusp of climate chaos, as we enter the age of the sixth extinction. This might be a question of science, it might be a question of spirituality, and I think it's both. For in the Potawatomi worldview, unlike in Western science, we don't locate science in isolation. from spirit. We honor that human beings have it four ways, at least four ways, of understanding the world with mind, body, emotion, and spirit, and that to understand a thing, we must use them all. And you know, fortunately, we human beings have devised an amazing technology that does use them all, that combines mind, body, emotion, and spirit into the most effective communication technology ever devised. My students have that same quizzical look, and then they answer the question of what technology might that be. They say Google. I say it's the story. The story. This question of what does the earth ask of us is so rarely heard in Western society, but it is of deep importance to indigenous cultures, so deep that it is essential in most of our creation stories. So using that amazing technology, I want to begin this morning with a story, a fragment of a creation story which is shared both by my Potawatomi people and our Haudenosaunee relatives. If I may ask Gish Kokwe, the Sky Woman, to join us and tell that story. In the beginning, there was the sky world, where people lived there very much as they do here on Earth, growing their gardens, raising their families. One difference, though, is that in the forest there grew the great tree of life, on which grew all different kinds of plants on the same tree, all the medicines, all the berries, all the fruits, all the grasses on the same tree. And one day, a great windstorm passed through the sky world and blew down the tree and opened at its base a huge hole in the ground where the roots had pulled up. And a beautiful young woman who we call Gish Kokwe, the Sky Woman, she went over to have a look. And she stood at the edge and she looked down, but she could see nothing because it was just entirely dark below. So she stepped a little closer. And the edge of the hole began to crumble. She felt herself falling, and so she reached out to stop herself by grabbing onto that fallen tree by her side, but the branch broke off in her hand. And she fell like a maple seed, pirouetting on an autumn breeze. A column of light streamed from a hole in the sky world, marking her path where only darkness had been before. But in that emptiness, there were many gazing up at this sudden shaft of light, and there they saw in the light, like a dust mote in the beam, a tiny object. And as it grew closer, they could see that it was a woman, with her black hair streaming behind her and her arms outstretched as she spiraled toward them. And the geese all nodded at one another and rose together on a wave of goose music. She felt the beat of their wings as they flew beneath and broke her fall. She caught her breath at the warm embrace of soft feathers. And so it began. From the beginning of time, we are told that the very first encounter between humans and other beings of the earth was marked by care and responsibility borne on the strong wings of geese. And the world at that time was covered entirely by water, and the geese couldn't hold Sky Woman forever, so they called a council of all of the beings to decide what to do. And a great turtle floated in their midst, and he offered to let her rest upon his back. And so gratefully, she stepped from the back of the geese onto the dome of the turtle. And the others all understood that she needed land for a home, and the deep divers among them had heard that there was earth way down at the bottom of the water. They'd never seen it, they'd never had need for it, but they had heard the story of its existence. And so Loon, who we call Mang in our culture, the strongest diver of all, said, "I'll go get it for her." And down he went. You know how long they can stay underwater. He was gone a long time, but when Mang resurfaced and shook his head and the water droplets splashed from him, he said, "I couldn't do it. It was too far. It was too long." He had nothing to show for his efforts. But the sturgeon said, "I can do this." And so the great 9-foot-long sturgeon made an attempt, and he too came back empty. He was followed by the beaver, by the otter, by all of those beings. Everyone came up with their ears ringing and gasping for breath, until the only one left was the muskrat, the little muskrat of all of the water beings. And he volunteered to go, the weakest diver of all, while all of the others looked on doubtfully. And his little legs flailed as he worked his way downward. He was gone a very long time. Everyone waited and waited, fearing the worst for their relative. And before long, a little stream of bubbles floated up from below, followed by the limp body of the muskrat. He had given his life to aid this helpless human being, an immigrant to this new world. But the others noticed that his paw was tightly clenched, and when they opened it, there it was, the little dab of mud, the little handful of earth. And Turtle said, "Here, put it on my back. I will hold it." And Sky Woman bent and spread the mud across the shell of the turtle. Moved by the gratitude of the animals, she began to sing with thanksgiving, and then began to dance, her feet caressing the earth with the same movement that we do today in our women's shuffle dance, where our feet never leave the earth. And as she danced her thanks, the land grew and grew and grew from that dab of mud on the turtle's back. And so the earth was made, not by one alone, but from the alchemy of the animals' gifts and human gratitude. Together they created what we call today Turtle Island. Our oldest teachings, this song, this story is millennia old. Our oldest teachings remind us that reciprocity is this thread that binds us together. What does the earth ask of us? They were her life raft at the beginning of the world. And now, so much closer to the end, we must be theirs. What does the earth ask of us? The answer to that question really depends on what we mean by earth, by the land. And in the Western worldview, there are some very particular meanings, aren't they, beyond this quantum of earth beyond, underneath our feet. And it is often construed as synonymous with property. Property to which we have certain rights by way of ownership. And in this country, land is also often understood as capital, as those natural resources we talked about. Scientists acknowledge this, that these ecosystem services, things like water purification, little things like oxygen to breathe, are also elements of what is land. But in the indigenous worldview, all of those things, most of those things are true too, but the meanings of land are far more complex and include a more holistic view, which has biophysical characteristics, but it is also a landscape of meaning. Land is understood both as a set of relationships, but moreover, as a set of responsibilities. The land is understood as our sustainer, certainly, as the home of our human and our more than human relatives. Land is the place where our ancestors taught us. Land is the very source of our identity. It's our pharmacy, it's our grocery store, it is our library. Land is the source of knowledge. Land as sacred, as inspirited, as church, as home. And between these two definitions, property and capital, and our sacred home, hangs another question. Is Earth merely a source of belongings for one species? Or is it the place where we, our most profound source of belonging? And this question is not just a philosophical abstraction. It's a very contemporary question. It is ancient and urgent at the same time. This is the same question that had prayerful water protectors defending sacred land in North Dakota, in a showdown with militarized police defending an oil company at Standing Rock. It is this question of belongings or belonging that is playing out in the Bears Ears National Monument, in the Gwich'in homelands, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and on an open pit mine that would poison the creation place of the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin. And not only for indigenous people, for every human who breathes the air and drinks the water and yearns to feel indigenous to the place that cares for them. This is a question for all of us. And that beautiful story of Gish Kokwe and the earth on turtle's back is an ancient formulation of this question. And we saw that the abundance of the earth was created, again, not by one, but by a gift exchange between living beings. Because let's remember that when Sky Woman came here, she did not come alone. What did she have in her hand? The branch from the tree of light, and over the back of the turtle, she spread all of those plant beings who are our gifts and our teachers. The earth was new then when it welcomed the first human, and it's old now, and there are some who suspect that we have simply worn out our welcome. These stories of reciprocity grow dim in our memory. How can we translate from stories at the world's beginning to the hour in which we live? Can we understand the Sky Woman's story not as an artifact from the past, but as instructions for the future? In return for the gift of the world on turtle's back, what will we give in return? For much of humans' time on the planet, prior to the last 500 years or so, before what I think of as the Great Delusion, we lived in cultures that understood this covenant of reciprocity, that in order for the earth to stay in balance, for these gifts to continue to flow among us, we have to give back in equal measure for what we are given. But we seem to have forgotten, and there are many forces allied to help us forget. And this notion of reciprocity, of gifts in motion, is not just good manners, it's actually how the biophysical world works. Based on or balance in ecological systems arises from what plant ecologists call negative feedback loops, reciprocal forces that keep the world in balance. We know these reciprocal forces, giving and taking, living and dying, production and consumption, biogeochemical cycles, water to cloud and back to water again. Reciprocity among parts of the living earth produces equilibrium, positive feedback loops in which interactions spin away from one another. They spin away from balance, away from equilibrium, producing radical change, often to a point of no return. Sound familiar? We have to understand that we, like every other successful organism that has ever lived on this planet, must play by the rules of the ecosystem. We may think ourselves different from all other beings, but you know what? The laws of thermodynamics have not been repealed just on behalf of our species. What does the Earth ask of us? Our first responsibility is gratitude. Now, gratitude might seem sort of like weak tea given the desperate challenges that lie before us, but it's powerful medicine. It's so much more than a simple thank you, because giving thanks implies a recognition, not only of the gift, but of the giver. When I eat an apple, my gratitude goes to that wide-armed tree whose offspring is now in my mouth. Their life has become my own. Gratitude is founded on this deep knowing that our very existence is contingent on the gifts of others. And the evolutionary advantage for gratitude is really very compelling, because this human emotion actually has adaptive value in sustainability. The practice of gratitude leads to a practice of self-restraint, because when you practice gratitude, you feel like you have everything you need, and so you don't consume as much. And did you know that eco-psychologists have shown us that people who practice gratitude in a deep way consume less than people who don't. And what is it that is driving climate change? Consumption. What is it that is pushing our plant and animal relatives to extinction? Our consumption. So gratitude can, in an important way, be a very powerful tool towards sustainability and a radical act in a consumer-driven society. And our indigenous story traditions are full of cautionary tales about what happens when gratitude and acknowledgement fail. When people forget to honor the gift, the consequences are always material as well as spiritual. The spring dries up, the corn doesn't grow, the animals do not return. The Western storytelling tradition is strangely quiet on this matter, and so we find ourselves in an era when we are justifiably afraid of our own atmosphere. We human people have protocols for gratitude. We apply them to one another with great skill. We say thank you. But I think that the next step in our cultural evolution, if we are to persist here as a species on this beautiful planet, is to expand our protocols of gratitude to the living earth. And gratitude is most powerful because it provides an opening to reciprocity, to living in such a way that the earth might be grateful for our presence. What does the earth ask of us? The earth calls us to attention. In a world that gives us maple syrup, spotted salamanders, and sandhill cranes, shouldn't we at least be paying attention? Paying attention is an ongoing act of reciprocity. It is the gift that keeps on giving, because attention generates wonder, which generates more attention, which generates joy. Paying attention to the more than human world doesn't lead only to amazement. It leads to an acknowledgement of pain. Open and attentive, we see and feel equally the beauty and the wounds, the old growth and the clear cut, the mountain and the mine. Paying attention to suffering sharpens our ability to respond, to be responsible. And this too is a gift. For when we fall in love with the living world, we cannot be bystanders to its destruction. Attention becomes intention, which coalesces itself to action. Deep attention calls us inevitably into relationship, and relationship is in many cases about knowing each other's names. It's a sign of respect to call someone by their name, and a sign of disrespect to ignore that they even have one. It's not just because I'm a botany professor that I focus on this question, but ethnobiologists tell us that our grandparents probably knew the name of more than 100 plant species. They had to. They lived among them. They were neighbors. Did you know that today the average American can recognize more than 100 corporate logos and fewer than 10 plants? And one of the plants on that list is Christmas tree. So I think it's really 9. We have lost an entire vocabulary of relationship, of knowing. How can we care for them? How can we monitor their well-being and fight for their existence if we don't even know their names? And the world seems a whole lot less like a shopping bag full of commodities and more like a gift when you know the one who gives you aspirin for your headache. Her name's Willow. She lives up there by the pond. She's a neighbor to Maple, that one who offers you syrup for your Sunday morning pancakes. Paying attention is a pathway to reciprocity. Is it a surprise, given our fluency in corporate logos versus the ones who truly sustain us, that we have accepted a political system that grants legal personhood to corporations and no status at all for maple trees or salamanders? Learning names is a powerful act of support on their behalf. It opens the door to reciprocity. What does the earth ask of us? Respect. a notion that has so many dimensions, more than we could talk about this morning. So I want to just choose one, given our theme of words matter. Let's explore the notion of our language, something that we all have control over. Most of us here speak English, native languages of these lands, in many cases nearly lost through assimilation and linguistic imperialism, by which I mean the renaming of everything by colonists. I'm pretty sure the original name of Peterborough was not Peterborough. This claiming of place by renaming, by using new words, is probably most evident in when we think about the sacred Bear Butte of the Lakota people, which was renamed Devil's Tower. There's violence done in linguistic imperialism. But the one word that I want to talk about this morning, I think one of the most egregious examples of linguistic imperialism is captured in a tiny little word, and that word is it. As speakers of English, we know that our grammar, in our grammar, we refer to our family and to other human beings with a grammar of personhood. We say he or she. If you imagine your grandma standing in the kitchen, would you ever say, "Oh, look, it's making soup"? You would not. You would not. It's deeply disrespectful, no? You steal her personhood. You denigrate her. You make her nothing more than the spoon that she's holding in her hand. You make her into an object. And yet, in English, we have no other way of speaking of the living world than it. We speak of that maple tree, of that blue jay, with itting, as if they were objects. In the Potawatomi language, that's impossible. You know, we just heard the truck go by. We have a different verb for hearing a truck than hearing a robin singing, because we have a different grammar for that which is alive and that which is not. Linguistics code for our relationships to the world. They delineate the boundaries of what and who we care about. And it's a matter of who's a who and who's a what, right? When Maple is an it, we can take up the chainsaw. When Maple is a her, we at least have to think twice about our actions. And in the Potawatomi language, as I said, our whole grammatical structure is set up so that it is impossible to speak of the living world as an object. We address the living world with the same grammar that we address our families, because it's our family. And the damage that is done, the violence that is done by a language which is part of a worldview objectifying nature, treating everything as if it was just stuff and all of that stuff belonged to us, is a powerful form of linguistic imperialism that we all suffer from. And I've given a great deal of thought to this grammar, particularly as a scientist, because when I write my scientific papers, after having spent decades literally on my knees before these plants who are teaching me, I have to write about them as if they're an object, as if they are an it, so like the pencil with which I am recording and writing their life stories. And I found that this was, it is for me deeply troubling. And so in thinking about this with full acknowledgement of the animacy of the language of indigenous peoples, I've been trying to think about and do a little thought experiment on how we might animate the English language, give ourselves a way out of this trap of having to objectify the beings that we care so much about. And in our language, we have a word, bimadazi aki, which means the living, a living being of the earth. And I have no illusions that that beautiful word will find its way into the English language. But bimadazi aki, that last word, aki, means the earth. What about that last sound? What about ki? Might we speak of the world with he, she, ki? And it, so that we have an animate pronoun in English, so that rather than speaking of living beings as if they were nothings, we might speak of them with the same respect that we give to our families. And you know, we're going to need a plural too. And in that case, we don't have to borrow from Potawatomi and that lovely word ki. Although in Potawatomi, in some grammatical cases, when we want to pluralize something, we add an N. We already have that that word in English, don't we? And that word is kin. Might we speak of the living world as kin? When the geese are flying overhead, we don't have to talk about it. We could say, our kin are flying south for the winter. Have a good trip. Come back soon. We're going to miss you. I find it deeply ironic as someone who really was bored stiff by grammar in high school English, as who wasn't, right, that I would today be really working in the realm of thinking about grammar and pronouns, grammar as tools of conservation, grammar as tools of transformation of a worldview. And I like to think about ki and kin as the pronouns of the revolution. I would say also that with this notion of ki and kin, the world has called us to recognize the personhood of all beings, not just corporations and humans, but the personhood of all beings. How different our world would be if we extended the same respect to other species as we do to ourselves. Recognition of the personhood of other beings asks that we relinquish our perceived role as masters of the universe at the top of the biological hierarchy and celebrate instead our essential roles as equal members of the democracy of all species. Recognition of personhood in our language, in our law, in our behavior opens the door to ecological justice. It can be a powerful political force as well as an ethical stance. And as you know, our laws today are all about governing our rights to the land. But the shift that we need is to include the rights of the land, the rights for land to be whole and healthy, the right to exist. We can follow the lead of indigenous nations around the world, the Maori, who, as you may know, have their sacred Whanganui River declared a legal person. In the Ecuadorian constitution, it enshrines the rights of nature herself. To the Bolivian government, who likewise has a rights of nature clause in their constitution and brought before the United Nations the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth. I was so honored a few years ago to be asked by the General Assembly to address the United Nations in support of the Declaration of the Rights of Mother Nature, which simply say that nature has a right to exist, to persist, to regenerate, and to heal from our damage. That's all it says. In addressing the General Assembly, there were empty seats in that august body. They belonged primarily to what is known as the Global North, led by the absence of the United States. What if the bear's ears belonged to themselves? What if the Missouri River had the inherent right not to be filled with oil? Or Bristol Bay salmon had a right to their own homelands, their own spawning grounds? What if sugar maples were recognized with rights to exist, persist, and regenerate, and not have to become climate refugees as their homelands shrink due to climate change? There is a new system of jurisprudence emerging in support of this thinking. It's called the Rights of Nature Movement, and it's based on the idea that our laws should embody our values and be aligned with ecological principles. The rights of nature system is based on this notion that we need to think about the well-being of all, not only the well-being of humans. I don't have time to talk too much more about the rights of nature, but I urge you to go to rightsofnature.org if you're interested in learning more about this new system of jurisprudence that is happening on a scale from the local to the indigenous. I'm going to close with some of the last words of Braiding Sweetgrass, if I can find where I am here. There we go. Because one of the notions, the answer to the question of what does the earth ask of us, is to engage in reciprocity, to give our own gifts in return. I need to tell you just a little bit first about a ceremony that we have in our culture. It's called the Menedewak, or the giveaway. And unlike in Western society, when you're being celebrated, people give you gifts, right? In our way, if you are being celebrated because so much good things have happened to you, you're the one who gives the gifts. And in our Menedewak ceremony, there are gifts for everybody, and a dance follows, and we dance in this really happy way and then wave the gifts in the air. You'll hear a little bit of that. Let me close with these last words of Braiding Sweetgrass. We are all bound by a covenant of reciprocity. Plant breath for animal breath, winter and summer, predator and prey, grass and fire, night and day, living and dying. Water knows this, clouds know this, soil and rocks know they are dancing in a continuous giveaway of making, unmaking, and making again the earth. We live in a moral landscape. The land is reading us law over and over, but we forget to listen. Our elders say that ceremony is the way that we remember to remember. And in the dance of the giveaway, we remember that the earth is a gift that we have to pass on just as it came to us. Because when we forget, the dances we'll need will be for mourning, for the passing of polar bears, the silence of cranes, and the memory of snow. When I close my eyes and wait for my heartbeat to match that drum, I imagine people awakening for the first time to the dazzling gifts of the world and seeing them with new eyes, just as they teeter on the cusp of undoing. Maybe just in time. Maybe too late. Spread on the grass, they will see at last the giveaway that Mother Earth has prepared for us. Blankets of moss, robes of feathers, baskets of corn, vials of healing herbs, silver salmon, sand dunes, thunderheads, snowdrifts, cords of wood, and herds of elk, tulips, potatoes, luna moths, and berries. More than anything, I want to hear a great song of thanks rise on the wind. I think that is the song that might save us. And then, as the drum begins, we will dance, wearing regalia in celebration of the living earth, a waving fringe of tall grass prairie, a whirl of butterfly shawls, nodding plumes of egrets, jeweled with the glitter of phosphorescent waves. And when the song pauses for those honor beats, we'll hold high our gifts and sing our praises for a shining fish, a branch of blossoms, and a starlit night. The moral covenant of reciprocity calls us to honor our responsibilities for all we have been given and for all that we have taken. It's our turn now, long overdue. Let us hold a giveaway for Mother Earth. Spread our blankets out for her and pile them high with gifts of our own making. Imagine the books, the paintings, the poems, the clever machines, the compassionate act, the transcendent ideas, perfect tools, the fierce defense of all that has been given. Gifts of mind, heart, voice, and vision, all offered up on behalf of the earth. Whatever our gift, we are called to give it and dance for the renewal of the world. In return for berries, in return for birds, in return for the privilege of breath. Mi iu, mi quech, taneto. Miigwech.